Greetings, everyone. This is the Castebris podcast. This is episode 4 of the series 2 run of the new series of Doctor Who that we've been doing. I'm James McLean. With me is author and editor of the Doctor Who Companion, Philip Bates.
Hello.
That's hi, James. Good hello there. And today we're talking about Lucky Day. This is going to be, I think the internet's going to be surprised, this is going to be the leanest podcast ever done. This is going to be so lean. It's going to be so tight. It's going to be so lean.
Are we stopping there?
It's tempting, isn't it? I was wondering whether to go with that and just play that joke forward. But yeah, so it's going to be leaner this week than it has ever been before. I suppose in context, it's lean in context to me rather than lean compared to other podcasts or any other sort of forms of categorization like time duration, content. It's lean. I think I'm already breaking this. I think I'm breaking this leanness already, but we're going to try and keep it lean because that's what the editor has told me to do. Keep it lean. So lean it will be. Lucky Days, episode 4. This one, I don't know, do we need to do a synopsis for this? I kind of feel like if people are tuning into this, they'll kind of know what the episode was about. This is the Ruby Sunday episode, which has just aired on what had been the 3rd of May. Yeah, so this is kind of like this is very much the sort of Love and Monsters of the series again, where it seems, doesn't it, like they've obviously got one unit filming someone, they've done this unit here. I mean, to be fair, the budget on this seemed to be quite reasonable, so it didn't seem to be quite as budgetarily tight as Love and Monsters, but that's kind of the sense of what this one is. So this one was written by Pete McTighe, primarily starring Millie Gibson as Ruby Sunday, with guest stars or cameos from the Doctor and Belinda at the beginning and at the end, bookending it. So I just think this week, just go straight into it. And yep. Philip, come on, tell me what you thought. What did you think? Oh, actually, I'll caveat that. What did you think of this and how did that relate to how you've thought of the season so far?
Oh, okay. I've enjoyed the season generally, but I would say that this is the first episode I have fully enjoyed since about 27.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a bold claim, I would say, but I very much enjoyed it. There have been other great episodes in that time, I would say. Boom was very good. The Well I enjoyed. Others were sort of average. I quite enjoyed Lux, but it was slightly let down for me because it felt like a retread to some degree of Tooth and Claw. And then this one, like you said, it felt like a retread of Love and Monsters. And then suddenly, the big twist. And I think that worked beautifully, really, really nicely.
Now, I'm throwing the leanness out the window. I want to go back to that whole thing of Lux and Tooth and Claw. Do you want to just expand a little on that? Because that's quite it's not one that I'd instantly jump to as a comparison. What do you mean with that?
Oh, okay. I mean, obviously, historical setting and all of that, but that's, yeah. Mm. Other than that, though, the sort of denouement, how they defeated Lux was basically the same as the werewolf. The werewolf drowned in moonlight and Lux drowned in sunlight. It was overfeeding the monster what it wanted. It was basically an atypical runaround. I did enjoy Lux, and it had the same, that it had solid horror tropes like Tooth and Claw. But ultimately the ending let me down a little bit with that. Plus I hated the fan section. I thought that was...
Oh, you hated the fan section.
Yeah. But yes, Tooth and Claw was one that I had a fairly similar reaction to Lux as well, in that I didn't initially like it that much. And then the more I thought about it and the more I rewatched it, then it grew on me. And now I really like Tooth and Claw. Lux, I think, will get better upon rewatches, but I'm not that eager to rewatch just yet. But yeah, I think this season so far has been a bit like Russell's, maybe not greatest hits, but some of his hits, at least in tone, I think. Yeah.
Well, he does seem to be, on the whole, while trying to shift the format a little more into a sort of fantasy setting to some degree, fantasy or gods. Yeah. It does feel like there is a certain amount of borrowing from his previous run. The Ruby Sunday had a little bit of the Billy feel to it, certainly in the early episodes. You say you've got Tooth and Claw, Lux episode twos as well. Episode yep. twos of his second seasons as well.
Actually. Yeah.
So they dovetail very nicely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there does feel like while he's done changes, he has fairly kept close to his his winning ingredients from before, where he might see his winning ingredients were from before.
Yeah, and I think series 1, 2, 3 all had first episode contemporary Earth, second episode historical, third, or maybe not series 2 actually, but you get like one in the past, one in future, and then around about episode 3 or 4 you get a return to contemporary Earth. And obviously you can't really do that with Belinda at the moment because she's cut off. So I think bringing back Ruby for that episode worked very nicely to stand off.
Are you a fan of Ruby Sunday?
It's a funny one because initially I thought, yep, she's fine. She's sort of placeholder companion in a way. And then I was writing a book about all the companions and I thought, well, actually there's more meat to her than I initially thought. 73 yards obviously added a lot to the bone. But yeah, I think there was more to appreciate when coming back to her era. Are you a fan?
Not particularly. Okay. I think she performs. I think Millie Gibson performs more than fine. I think she does fine in this episode. I find her just a placeholder companion. I feel that she is an amalgam of virtually every other piece of companion that we've seen. You know, the mysterious character for the first season, a la sort of Jenna Coleman. Yeah. As the Billy Piper with a little bit of it just feels like Amy. It just feels very, very constructed. And I find she doesn't bring anything to me. I think, again, with the series now in what it's 20 years from when it kicked off.
Yeah.
And I think, as I said in other podcasts, there's times where I feel like Doctor Who's biggest weakness is that it's become so, despite being a very progressive and show which is entirely flexible and fluid in format, it seems to become very anchored in its own truths. And this idea that the Doctor's always got to have the younger female companion, you know, as you say, things like they have to go to the past and then to the future. It's just that the TARDIS has got to inside just become bigger and bolder each time we see it. And it just feels like things where it feels caught and unable to move forward. So I think Millie is a bit of that. I find Belinda slightly more refreshing in the way that she's written. So,
yeah.
But absolutely, I don't think the issues I have with this episode, and I do have some, were anything to do with the performances or even the writing at all. But yeah, I think my issue with it is that for the first 25 minutes or so before you get that turn in the story, I was just absolutely bored. I just just did not care. Okay. I found Conrad, as he is initially, very dull. And obviously, retrospectively, you can see what they were doing. Very insipid and just not interesting or charming. I didn't care about her relationship, was not interested. I found the Shrek a bit, okay, they look like things we've seen before. I don't really feel anything here. And I just felt, I think also because we've had so little really of seeing Shooty and of obviously Belinda as well. And knowing that this is only like an eight episode run, to sort of be pulled out of that into a, what was clearly going to be a sort of Love and Monsters episode. I resented that a bit. I was like, I don't want this right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Dr. Light thing at the moment is quite an issue because I think we've had what, three episodes already without Shooty around.
Yeah.
Which is kind of mad. And it's all because I think he was filming Sex Education, something like that. So, I remember there was an interview released sort of last week with Jonah, who plays Comrade, and he was saying he'd never seen Millie in Doctor Who because those episodes weren't even out yet. And I think that's a problem. And so the Dr. Light thing was fine if you've got 13 episodes to play with. Eight, you're going to feel cheated, I think.
Yeah, that's where I felt. And we don't know yet if this is going to play into a larger story, especially with Conrad, whether that's got any legs for the rest of the season. So maybe it'll tie in. And obviously we have this weird tie-in that they start off at the very beginning with this whole lucky day with the 50p piece, which again may have some repercussions or some explanations to the major mystery of this series.
Yeah, I found that because early on when it was after the podcast, was the podcast called Lucky Day or something? Because he was carrying posters with it on. So I don't know what that was about. But I do know that later on in the series, there are posters with him on, preaching about, you know, truth and whatnot. So I would presume that this stuff comes back to haunt the Doctor.
It could be, absolutely. I mean, the podcast was pretty lean as well. They had a lean podcast in
there. Oh, yeah.
I thought it was lean.
Quality gets lean. Everything.
Absolutely. Got a lot to learn from that. In a sense, from what started to seem like initially a bland rerun of what we'd seen before, they play this turn and we suddenly get a story which is very much where Russell seems to be these last two series. And I think, to be fair to him, was where he was back in series one, series two, back in 2005. There's a sort of very strong politicization playing out here, perhaps not directly in your face, but certainly a subtext talking about sort of narratives, a sort of cultural sway through media narratives and media persons or what did you make of this? Did you feel, because I hear quite a lot, or I've seen quite a lot of people sort of go, they don't like Doctor Who when it becomes politicized, which of course is kind of crazy because the whole beast is always been fairly political. But clearly when the message is very in your face, and I always think it's very in your face when you're living it. I think if you were watching the Sunmakers back in the 70s, the commentary in there would have been quite in your face as well, because you know what it was kind of talking about.
Yeah.
As the Happiness Patrol was, when I watched Happiness Patrol, I knew exactly what it was talking about. So this whole thing that Doctor Who's suddenly becoming too political, I think, well, it's always done this. But obviously, it's doing it at the moment. What were your feelings on that?
I know where you're coming from, but I get annoyed by the people online who say, oh, Doctor Who's always been political. Yes, I think it has, but I think it can be more subtle and smarter and a bit less preachy. For instance, the Doctor turning up later on in Lucky Day, and he preached a little bit to Comrade about essentially him spreading fake news. And that, like, I I got what Conrad was meant to represent without the Doctor coming in and, you know, telling us. So I think it's probably a fine line to tread. It's probably quite hard as a writer to know where to stop, in a way.
Do you think some of that is from a writer, from an author's perspective, a sort of a there's a certain level of positioning where you see a lot of shows like this, a lot of sci-fi shows which are still playing with a lot of subtext, tend to be written by people on a sort of either liberal to left side of the fence politically.
Yeah.
And I suppose if you are in that space, it must become quite frustrating when you see a lot of people kind of almost co-opting that or arguing out for the other side. You don't see it perhaps so much with, well, I suppose you do see it with Doctor Who, but you certainly see it with things like Star Trek, which is, you know, meant to be a utopian future. And then as soon as they make a very political message, there'll be, you know, fans will be going, what are you doing? This show shouldn't be political. How dare you say that we should be, you know, what, you know, white gay people in Starfleet, you know, and you think, well, but that's, I imagine as an author, if you have a certain positioning of your, of that character, maybe that in some way is a sort of sense of them trying to sort of clearly position where they see that character. And again, there could be arguments whether that's not a thing that writers should do, but it could that be some of it here, the sort of sense of going, yeah, that's be, from Russell T. Davies. Well, obviously it's from Peter's point of view, right? But I suppose Russell as well, that this character is about this. And we want to make it clear this is what this character stands for.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. But I don't, it's difficult because I don't think, like, human rights, I don't think it should be a political issue in a way. I don't think it's, do you know what I mean?
It is.
Yeah. But I sort of see the Doctor as being above that. I think it was Stephen Moffat saying that he was once attacked one of his episodes of Doctor Who being too left-leaning. And then some of the liberal side of things said, oh, it's too right-leaning. And he sort of said, well, that's, if you're getting complaints from both sides, you're doing something right. And I think that's quite interesting. I think that's probably the sweet spot for Doctor Who. I don't think you're supposed to really know the Doctor's politics.
I suppose, but in theory, we kind of do. I would argue we probably do. And yet, I think this is where, as you say, there's a bit of swings, because you can see how... Do we see the Doctor's politics? We do see the Doctor's politics. Do the Doctor's politics map into our political spectrum?
Yeah, that's
probably
it.
Not.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I'm because to be fair to Russell, there was that very nice moment in the Christmas Invasion where they have this Labour leader who is, in theory, a left side politician who he brings down because he doesn't feel that their ideology.
Yeah,
which could be seen as left as right leaning. I think these days, what's very clear in our television, well, sorry, in our world today, that there's no longer left and right. There's like a quadrant. There's left, right, local, and global. And you can have left leaning local people. You can have left leaning global people who are support sort of boundaries because they're concerned about immigration, maybe in their town. They can be on the left. They can be on the right as well. So we've got. It's not so easy to sort of say what politics are. And I think in that sense, the Doctor is very blurred. It's very hard to sort of say what he stands for. And as you say, I think the argument has always been, and it's probably true, he doesn't really have a political standing. He is, as you said at the beginning, there for rights, I suppose, living rights, human rights, if we want to use a singular speciesist term.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great example, Christmas Invasion, actually, because I don't think it was made... I can't remember it being overtly said that Harriet Jones was Labour, particularly, to be honest. I can't remember. So I like that really you're not sure, because it doesn't really matter. You're judging her on her, not her political persuasion in a way?
I think it was because she was the next prime minister in, and it was sort of suggested that it was the government of the time. She was taking over because she was in the same cabinet. I think there was this assumption, because at the time it was Labour, that she was Labour, and yet it wasn't a Labour that. And I think now, as you say, it was a nice position to just kind of show the Doctor isn't a Labour supporter, he's not a Conservative supporter. If someone does something wrong, he'll bring them down. I suppose one of the arguments some people might say he or they is a more of a right-wing character is that he's very anti-establishments, and establishments tend to exist, not always. I mean, they consist on both sides, but large government, big government, tends to be something considered as something on the left rather than, well, again, it depends on what your right wing. You could argue he's libertarian and likes to want to break down big government structures, as we see in the States at the moment. They're sort of talking about, you know, wasteful government and trying to wheedle out and reduce government wasted spending. And I suppose someone from that side could see the Doctor as someone who's pro that, and would be like, yeah, he'd be the same, because he's always anti-authoritarianism and not just authoritarianism, sorry, as a political movement, but in terms of bureaucracy. He hates bureaucracy. He hates, you know, he's a very individual agent. Yeah, he knocks all sort of politics aside, does what he wants. And I'm just wondering, going back to that point you were just saying, is like, is he at the end, is that what they're doing? Are they trying to actually give him a position where he's not being political per se? Because we could have loud, powerful pundits from either side of the spectrum. But obviously, I think we're talking about, we don't even need to give names of who we think he's talking about. It's interesting.
It's interesting as well. I think it's exemplified because we know Russell T. Davis's politics.
Yes.
And I would say we're fairly educated about Pete McTighe's politics as well. I would say he's probably got similar beliefs to Russell. So perhaps we're reading more into that
because
we're aware. But then I don't know, say if we went back to 1970, I don't know if people were aware, like Malcolm Hulk was a communist, for instance. Now everybody knows. Back then, I don't know. You know? So I'd be interested to find out when people learnt of that, and if there were any criticisms of that. Because I was thinking about the Third Doctor. A lot of people say he's quite right-wing.
Mm.
And really, in classic Doctor Who, I never looked at the Doctor's politics at all. Not in our political way.
No, exactly.
Yeah,
I agree with you. I think that's true.
And I'm not sure when that changed particularly, really.
The fascinating thing is that in a way the hero themselves of any brand is actually quite a right-leaning character type, because it's a character type which defies all authority that comes from any sort of state structures or service structures. You know, they will go against the police, they'll go against the politicians, they'll go against doctors. The hero sets themselves out as the individual's knowledge is far more is far more pure and righteous than the knowledge of any collective group. Collective stuff is seen as bad, individual rights seen as great. That would perhaps be argued to be perhaps as more of a slightly right-wing leaning ideology, which is what most characters have.
Yeah, that's very true, yeah.
But they are written often by people who are, because they're artists and they work in art and the creative industries, tends to be a space where people don't always, but tend to be a little more left-leaning, tend to be written by left-wing, right? But the actual notion of a hero is very much a sort of, we're not talking about that they are right-wing in their politics, but the nature of being anti-administration, anti-bureaucracy, anti-having to obey law, and just go by your own gut, your truthiness. You know, your gut tells you the right way to go, which is what The Last Jedi was quite clever about, I thought, when they flipped that with Poe, who does all the things that heroes do through that film. You know, they disobey orders, and yet at the very end of it, he just decimates the rebellion because he's gone with his gut rather than the collective knowledge of those generals and everyone above him. It's very rare we see that flipped. But here we do. See, leanness is out the window here, isn't it? But yeah, anyway, I think, yeah, we've gone way off. But I think politics in this episode, you can't really ignore. And you don't have to necessarily have a position on it, but there's certainly a lot going on here to talk about. What did you feel about Conrad, about the character, the portrayal?
Like you said, they bring him in as a quite a dull character. He's a slightly more dull Elton from Love and Monsters. Met the Doctor when he was young. It was quite obvious that he was never going to take the serum. I thought it would be because he wants to meet the Doctor. But so then the betrayal, I think, worked really very well. I very much enjoyed it, and it took the episode into territory I wasn't expecting at all. Which made me actually not miss the Doctor in a way, because I think we saw the grit of Kate, for instance. You know, I could see where it was going, that she was going to let the shriek out, but that was okay. I think sometimes leaning into character, into audience expectations, is good when you've just subverted them, like a couple of scenes ago. And so that betrayal gave us time to see the grit of not only Kate, but also the Doctor, which I liked.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I was interested when you sort of said about why he didn't take the serum when I was watching it. I was thinking, this is because obviously he didn't know where this turn was going to happen and this betrayal. I was like, this is what I hate about this character, because it's so ridiculous. To me, it was like, I thought he was going to say, didn't take the serum because actually I just didn't believe it. At the time, I didn't believe it enough to take some fluid that I didn't know. You know, why would I? I thought that was going to be the answer. And I thought, this is a ridiculous answer. But of course, if they'd run with that, that would have perhaps, well, I don't know, you could argue that would have flowed, that would have led into the reveal better. But I think it would maybe made the reveal seem a little less surprising. I don't know, because you might have perhaps, you might have been a little more suspicious about how much he believes her if he'd sort of said that. So, yeah, I thought that was a really interesting moment too.
And also, I think if he hadn't have met the Doctor when he was young, if he hadn't have... I think he saw the TARDIS materialise, didn't he? I can't quite remember. I think he did. But otherwise, your sort of on-off girlfriend saying, take this, it's going to put you to sleep for 8 hours. Weird. You know? So, yeah, I could see that. I could appreciate that as a notion. I think also Conrad, even though he was quite dull, he was likable enough that when the betrayal came into things, it hit, you know. And also I felt there was a bit of 73 yards about the being in a pub in a village. So you expect things to go quite slowly from there on still.
So I think Howard King's portrayal was a bit bland to watch initially, which I think the problem with the episode was it had to do what it had to do what it wanted to do later. So it had to be fairly bland. It had to make him quite boring. It had to do it in a way which, when the turn came, that he was quite a grotesque character, and that had to really be a surprise. So I think what they did was quite risky, because, like I said, I was watching it and I was close to turning off. I was just so disinterested. So that was it. Yeah. That was a danger zone there, and they went for it, and I think it paid off. I think what also is good about his character was, and I think this made him one of the most chilling villains I've seen on the show, is that there's no sense that you'd ever be able to get around his sense of destiny, power, self-belief, whatever you want to call that, which I think is true of a lot of people in positions of power around the world. It just reminds you that there's people we see on the television, or you see, and I'm sure this goes for both sides of the political spectrum, who you'd think, if I could just explain this to them. But
yeah,
you know that if you could, or it wouldn't make a difference.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's why that last scene with the doctor was so interesting. I reject your reality was quite hard hitting, I think. And I loved seeing the doctor like that. You don't see that grit in this doctor so much.
No.
I would say. So when you do, very effective. And he somewhat subverts or plays with something that the 11th Doctor said in A Christmas Carol of, I've never met someone who wasn't important before. And it's very sort of egocentric sort of viewpoint of, oh, everybody's important. But then you find out that sometimes that importance isn't good.
Yeah.
And the doctor can make you realize that and bring you down. But with some people, even that's not effective.
Yeah. Something I've always disliked about, I think, 2005 plus, especially with the doctor, a little bit, you could argue, well, I'll explain in a second, but is that he always talks about how everyone's important. And yet he's very specific who he hangs out with. And he's always very keen on meeting people with who have historical significance. The small people of the time, not interested in. But he'd be really interested in sort of bumping into Hitler or, you know, Margaret Thatcher. Regardless of his own politics, he would find that interesting. And again, this is just to do with writing, obviously. And I know he used to say it a lot in the old series, but in that time, you were never quite sure whether it was true or not, or whether these were just tall tales. But certainly in 2005 onwards, as soon as he meets someone famous, he's very, very excited. And there's that horrible scene in Smith and Jones where he kind of dismisses someone as just not being of quality to come with him because they're too scared. And yet Martha isn't, in a sort of almost sociopathic way. And that's cool, you know. There's a weird thing going on with the Doctor in that, which again is down to writing. One thing I think on that front, I think what I did really like about this episode was this sort of PTSD thing they played with Ruby, which they've never really done before. And as I've said in previous weeks recently, it always annoys me, and I think you've alluded to it as well, that the companion is almost this sort of carefree backpacker going on a trip with the doctor, comes home for lunch and dinner with the mum, and then heads off again to the equivalent of heading off to Italy to some exciting adventure, and then comes back and feels a bit sad that they're missing this. And the show kind of ignores the fact that all they're doing in those adventures is watching people suffer, die in vast amounts and seeing absolute horrors. And I like this because it was the first time we had a companion sort of turn around and go, they didn't sort of say that that was a problem, but they were like their fight or flight being the thing that was,
yes.
I thought that was a really powerful thing to do, that would be something you'd be left with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they tried to hint at it with Martha, because she had to leave the TARDIS because of the year that never was. But they just made her into a soldier, essentially. You know, she became unit medic.
Yeah.
So it wasn't properly dealt with. And I don't think Ruby's PTSD has been put to bed, but I think that's better, really. And I think it's good that she has seemingly left unit as well. At the end of this episode, she seems to have gone, oh no, this isn't a good fit for me. And yeah, I think that adds a lot to her as a companion that makes her quite different in the way that you said earlier. You said that you found the start of this episode boring because, you know, there just wasn't a load of pull into it. But I think that partly depends on how you feel about Ruby. For me personally, mm-hmm, it was definitely. oh good, she's back. Yeah. And I don't know whether much of the audience is going to feel like I did, considering it was only 8 episodes last year, and all the companions at the moment, because there's only 8 episodes, sadly Belinda included, they don't seem like fully fledged companions yet.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, interestingly, I don't know if you have, especially given that you've got the Doctor Who companion and the like, but I was just looking on the social media, I was looking at the BBC account, the Doctor Who account, just looking at some of the responses. While I was quite mixed on the episode, I was quite pleased to see that most people were really positive to it, because I want people to enjoy it. If I don't enjoy it and I see everyone else enjoy it, I think, oh, that's great. I don't feel I've so much, it's not so much of a waste of time. It's just a personal preference. Okay. But yeah, there seem to be a lot of people who've seemed very happy with this series so far, which seemed quite unusual.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to see a season be accepted a bit more. I don't think it's going to be like a classic, but I like a lot of seasons that aren't seen as classics. So I think it's good that for some people, perhaps growing up now, they think, oh, actually, do you know what was great? Shooty's second season of Doctor Who. That's brilliant. I wouldn't say his first season was that great, in truth. But to think that he's actually got some good episodes under his belt now feels a lot better.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I mean, I quite liked the last season. I think, like you were saying earlier, I think there was a distinct feeling of absence to the character. And even when the story itself wasn't damaged by it, like, say, 73 Yards, which was one of the better stories of the season for me.
Yeah.
It did feel like you were missing something when you really wanted time to actually... You needed him. You wanted him there to sort of get used to him, get a feeling of the flavour of that character. And I certainly think by the Christmas episode, we were feeling it. And from here on, it's been a lot stronger. I mean, I think the first four have been very good. I agree with you. The one I was the least favourite was Lux. That was the one that did less for me. And I think for me, while I'd not thought of Tooth and Claw, I was very much in that position of feeling... Yeah, I kind of feel I've seen this sort of stuff done before. This is done well, yeah, but it's not giving me anything new. It feels very much of the old Doctor Who type. But this all feels like it's still trying to do different things. And this story especially. One of the things I did notice online people were questioning or complaining about was Lethbridge Stewart. And they felt that, or the question of, and I'd like to ask you this, did you feel that... I suppose firstly, did you think that she was going to let Conrad die? And two, do you feel that was in character for that character? And or I suppose three, why do you think she did it? What was your reasoning behind that sort of more extreme approach? What sent her to that space?
Oh, that's interesting. I think Kate Stewart gets a lot of flack. And I think what might have pushed her, to a degree at least, was Conrad talking about her father. I think that struck a chord. It hit a nerve, and there was a point where I thought she might let him die. But then I thought, well, she's got Ruby like right next to her, so maybe she won't. And I think us questioning whether it is in character at this stage might be good, because really we've seen a lot of, Kate's been in a lot of episodes, but I think there's still a lot more to her character to explore. And I don't think the romance angle is interesting to be honest. Whereas, oh, does she have the steeliness of her father, who, you know, killed a load of Silurians back in the day?
Yeah.
I think that's more interesting than, oh, she's fallen for a colonel. What did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was well written. I think the whole point of UNIT, and it was kind of the point of Torchwood, was to show that if you don't have the omnipotent power of the Doctor in this, in your space, you're going to have to make some very human decisions, hard human decisions. And they've made it clear that there was a lot of technology there that would be would be released out into the globe. So to set that up.
Yeah.
So that's I think I agree with you. Obviously, the Lethbridge Stewart is meant to be the sort of point where it pushes her to a point where she makes her call. But I think you need that. You need that feeling that without the Doctor, stuff can still be resolved, but it might not be resolved as cleanly. And it might be, we will have that hint of human choices, and she's a soldier. So I think a lot of soldiers would have played that card. So I didn't feel it was out of character at all. And I think it did the right thing.
Yeah, and plus, in the Day of the Doctor, when the Zygons threatened to release basically all the technology of the Black Archive, she was going to set off a nuke in London.
Yeah.
So, you know, let this one horrible man die. It's no biggie. You know. I've loved UNIT's part in this, actually. I thought it was a very strong episode for UNIT, and I think it bodes well for the eventual spin-off.
The eventual? Any idea? I thought that was meant to have been at back end of last year. What happened? Do you know anything about that?
No. So I think it's due later this year.
Oh, but maybe I got the wrong year.
No, I think there were reports that it might have been the tail end of last year, but they filmed it far too late. I think they filmed it sort of 6 weeks after finishing Doctor Who, essentially. So I presume it's coming out later this year, but if Doctor Who isn't picked up for another season, which I think it will be, in truth. I've heard rumours otherwise. I've heard lots of rumours, particularly of regeneration. And I do think something's got to change, but I've faith that at some point it'll get picked up. Maybe not next year, maybe the year after, something like that. In truth, I think it's better to go on a bit of a hiatus. 5 years would do, with that, 5 years not on air, I think would do the show a lot of good, in a way. It would be terrible for my site, though.
One of the things that would be just quickly nice to talk about would be that notion, which I've talked about with others on the podcast the last few weeks, is that future. And one of the arguments I've been putting forward is that I have a sort of slight concern that Doctor Who's in a position where, as a show, as we know, which was made for a broadcast medium, it's now situated in a space where in the last 12 years, television has changed so dramatically. And that what it was, if it has a hiatus, what it could come back as, especially when we're seeing part of the problem at the moment is that it's not in a space now where it can pick up new audiences like it used to, because less and less people are watching BBC One, less and less people are clued in, more and more young people don't even watch any of that stuff and are watching YouTube. And that's, you know, it's not me being an old person being grumbly. It's just statistically, that's what we're seeing. The young generations are not moving away from that sort of way of watching television. How do you feel? What do you think there's a space for it to come back as it is, or would it feel, do you feel it would need to change?
I think something's got to change, but right now I don't know what, because quite honestly, I thought a lot of things that Russell has done recently, comparatively recently, were right. Bringing it out of solely BBC hands was probably quite a good move. Perhaps it's about audience metrics and how you know, this last episode was watched by, I think, overnights of 1.5 million, which is the lowest, I believe, ever. And we think, oh, that's rubbish. But it was the third most watched
of
the channel, you know, of that whole day. So, yeah, I genuinely don't know how it would come back.
But is part of the risk it's taken, part of the problem which it's got, that as soon as it leaves the comfort zone of public broadcasting and has moved into the sort of global commercial sphere of distribution through Disney, if Disney feel that it doesn't meet the metrics, whatever its metrics are, and in fairness, very few shows these days meet metrics to carry on regardless.
Yeah.
Has that been part of its threat? Because now it's in a point, if Disney pulls out, are the BBC in a space? Are the BBC now in a space where they're going to want to take this forward themselves?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think as a brand, I think the BBC are still interested because it still rakes in money. It's whether that brand will be sustained without it being on TV regularly. I think right now it's got a lot of dedicated fans who will carry on buying merchandise, you know, and still raking in the cash for the Beeb. So it is a difficult one because, as you say, streaming services, there's no long-term shows. There's no EastEnders of Netflix. There's nothing.
No.
So putting everything on iPlayer, for instance, was quite an interesting, solid move, I thought. Yeah. And also, I think they opened it up. I might be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure they opened it up so that all the previous episodes were signed for deaf people and things like that. And I think that's quite that's. That's a very positive move.
Mm. Well, the War Games and the Daleks as well were very cagey moves in trying to make the old catalogue more interesting to young people. I was talking to what I would call a young person the other day, and they were saying that how they were trying to show their partner Star Wars. And I was like, the age-old question. Did you do it from chronology of release or chronology of the internal story? Yeah. And they were like, we went from internal story. And when we got to episode 4, she was like, I'm glad you didn't show me episode 4 because this is really slow. So it's amazing how sort of 20th century film and television to new audiences can actually seem incredibly slow. So finding ways to sort of bring it together and give it a bit of pep, which the Daleks and the War Games try to do, as you say, seems to be another one of those smart moves to try and keep the brand alive, even if the show's not necessarily.
Yeah.
We don't know whether it's moving on, whether it's going to get its third and fourth seasons.
That's interesting because I sort of rail against the idea of youngsters not having that sort of attention span. Cause I thought, I did. When I was a kid, I was interested in watching Two Doctors or War Games or whatever without all the slower bits filtered out. But then I didn't have TikTok.
But then we've also got to be careful that if we look at Marvel movies, they still sit with it, you know, if they can, to our ranges. You know, Endgame, probably one of the biggest, you know, cinematic franchise hits in film history, you know, good 3 hours per, you know, moving to that sort of length.
Yeah.
People do have, they can watch stuff, even though they say, oh, there's no time for it. But I think maybe the pace of some scenes, the pacing rather than the duration, where people seem to loop. I don't know. It's interesting. And it's that careful thing, like you say, you don't want to get into a position where you're just sort of, as we see some people go, oh, this generation just can't concentrate. And I don't think that's what's going on here. It's almost like a style. It's a style you're used to. It's almost like saying classical music. No young person can listen to classical music because it's too slow. And it's like, well, yeah, it was digested differently back in certain periods, but it doesn't mean that people now can't get into it. But it's a certain style, which isn't the same as what they might hear on TikTok or YouTube.
I think as well the chopping stuff down approaches a younger audience in the same sort of patronizing way that the Time Team did in Doctor Who magazine, where I think one of them said that she liked watching Doctor Who on like double speed or something because the classic episodes were too slow, and all the readers were like, what, this is nuts. And Doctor Who magazine swiftly got rid of that feature because people kicked up. But essentially what the in color releases are is that same notion of, oh, people won't want to see 10 episodes. They'll want an hour and a half.
But is there not a little bit of truth, for a little kernel of truth in there, that if you see a Doctor Who episode, a story you were not familiar with when you were a kid or when you were younger, it can drag a bit, some of those older ones, because you don't have that natural nostalgia for it. You are still interested and you still might quite enjoy it, but you can't help deny that they are slower. And in fairness as well, most of them were meant to be watched in 20-minute bursts, 22-minute bursts, which most people try and watch the whole thing and feel like it feels a bit of a mess. It's because it was never meant to be watched like that.
Yes, yeah. I've got a big issue with binge watching. I don't binge watch anything because I don't think that's what TV is for.
No, that's a fair point.
You know, it's not made that you're not going to watch 12 episodes of EastEnders in a day, so why would you do it with Stranger Things or whatever? So that the binge watching nature of things annoys me. But again, people do it because I don't know why. I suppose they get carried away with the story, and
it's because we can, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's why print media is dying in part, is because if you wanted to get a magazine, like say even like SFX back in the day, that's fine. But now you have literal, you know, with hashtags, you can have commentaries, news on your favorite topic, which is just an infinite scroll.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Yeah, very true. Yeah. I think Marvel did something quite interesting with that, I thought, with they changed their model with putting episodes on Disney Plus. They went from all the episodes being released at one time to weekly releases, and that worked really well for them. Mm-hmm. I thought it generated a lot of interest each week. So yeah, it's really difficult with Doctor Who because I don't think there's a good enough answer for what it should be like right now.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think Stephen Moffat did a very good job in increasing the audience to America. And then it seemed to shrink a bit. So...
Well, yeah, because 2013 streaming comes in.
Maybe. You know, yeah, maybe.
That's when you start seeing that. I mean, there were other issues as well for national shrinkage.
Yeah.
The way that he split seasons, because he wasn't allegedly keeping up, wasn't able to manage as he was hoping to. So the season split, that, you know, as soon as you don't, and any American will tell you, any show which doesn't have a, you know, as Rick was saying the other week, if you don't have a show that's on a set time continually, certainly the days where before streaming or it was moved, that would be the death of the show. You know, you need to have that staple time slot, and Doctor Who hasn't had a staple time slot certainly since Moffat's era, which I don't think's helped.
Yeah,
but I think a lot of what we've seen with Doctor Who is, and I'll argue this a lot, is lot not to do with the quality, which has seen the shows dropping in ratings. It's the way that we consume. And back when the great Moffat was in there and the great Davis was back in the day, what did they have as competition? They had very little as competition except what people might see on Sky. There wasn't that much out there. Come 2013, you know, when Paul Capaldi's taking the reins, the ratings drop like crazy. I think a lot of it's down to the fact there's just so much now people are watching, which is just not, Doctor Who's less special. And I think that's another problem. It is less special now. It's less special to me too. And it's not because I don't like it. It's just so much to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's very hard to do event TV and things like that anymore. But then I think
it's... Good.
Sorry.
Yeah. I was going to say, which they're trying to do at the end of the series, aren't they? With the screenings for the two-part finale. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
Didn't they do that last year for Empire of Death? I can't remember.
I think they did.
Yeah, I feel like they might have done. But then I think it's even more important to have really good quality stories. I was watching Bergerac, the new Bergerac. So it's show run by Toby Whithouse.
Okay.
And obviously created by Robert Banks Stewart. And it's really, really good.
Oh, cool.
And it's on a comparatively obscure channel. It's U Drama or something. So I know the ratings are low. But that doesn't bother me in the same way that Doctor Who ratings do. And I think because the quality is great, I actively enjoy that and you know, similar shows more than Doctor Who. So I think if the quality's there, people might not care about the ratings so much. But I'm not sure. I think newspapers will. Newspapers will always worry about ratings or pretend to.
But I think also people who don't like an era will suddenly be more interested in ratings than when they do like an era. When they do like an era, they don't really care. When they don't, they'll suddenly be looking to see whether the overnights are bad to prove that their position is actually the answer, the true answer. And I'm skeptical on that. I for one, I actually enjoyed the show. I mean, Capaldi's last series was good, was better than it had been for me previously. But I actually enjoyed the Chibnall era because it just felt, while I won't pretend it was perfect, it was felt like a breath of fresh air after so many years, including Davis as well, where it just been this crazy, hyped up on speed show. And then suddenly it tried to shift the pace. And I enjoyed that. But I also knew that a lot of people didn't enjoy that. So, and had issues with some of the episodes. But yeah, I suppose my answer at the moment is, or my question at the moment is generally, is it about quality? I'm skeptical whether if we had Moffat in right now, whether it'd have exactly the same issues, or if it had Chibnall, or whether it had first generation Davis clone in charge. Because the issue here is less to do with the nuances of quality, but simply that there's just it's not able to do what it used to do, which is have a life cycle of audiences. It can't bring new audiences into the frame, because for the last 10 years, they're just not really there anymore because the television has changed.
Have you got an idea of if Doctor Who came off air for 5 years, how would you like to see it come back? How do you think, is there a way to regain audiences?
Well, I think I said to Rick the other week, the way I would do it, the two ways I'd do it would be, I would give it, like with James Bond, I would do TV movies. James Bond, I've said I would do James Bonds in different eras. So I'd do 70s James Bond film, I'd do a 60s James Bond film. There'd be no chronology. They would just be standalone James Bond films, which you could stunt cast. And I would do the same with Doctor Who. I would stunt cast, which I think Timeless Child has allowed that flexibility to do, and just have a name of the week doing either a TV movie or a miniseries or a film that could be event television, as you said, and do it like that and just take it away. Or alternatively, my other, I've said this now 3 weeks in a row, which might sound like I'm pitching it, I'd do something which is like The Walking Dead. I'd have a load of post-apocalyptic people find a police box that is, and then end up on a time travel with them, and that group shifts and changes. Some live, some die, and it just revolves. And so you have a whole load of human people running crazy around the universe in a ship they can't control, going from place to place, picking up new people, losing people, and just try and break the format. Because I think the format is what's strangling it a bit, is that we just almost every, like you say, we can say, oh, this is a Love and Monsters episode. It's like, we shouldn't be able to say that because we're so locked in. I feel like we're going to have to tie up here because Christian did ask for a lean podcast. So this is about as lean as he's going to get from me. Yeah, apparently so. I don't know. I just, he comes in occasionally, barks an order, and then I decide how I'm going to undermine it in whatever way I can. But we'll try and keep it lean.
So just another 2 hours, do you think? Or
yes, it's tempting, isn't it? Just to give him more to edit. Bless him. I think we'll just end off just a couple of people on the Patreon who left comments on this episode. I know it's on social media. I'm always worried about giving people's names. I'm just going to assume the names are pseudonyms. They might not be their real names. You know, so a person who's decided to call themselves Andrew Brooke has said, nice idea, but terrible execution. The only way the first half could have been duller would be if Ruby was dressed as Andy Pandy and she'd been hanging around in a nuclear power station. Nice idea, but terrible execution. The only way the first half could have been duller would be if Ruby was dressed as Andy Pandy and she'd been hanging around a nuclear power station. Am I missing something there? Because that actually sounds quite interesting to me.
I think it sounds like this person isn't a fan of Hand of Fear.
Hand of Fear.
Yes.
Yeah, I get it. Fair point. I like that. So that's kind of cool. You're taking a swing, but you're also taking a swing at classic as well. There's a bit of objectivity. I like that. Yeah. Let's see another one. Phil Fernan said, after seemingly improving the series, this episode didn't engage me at all. The theme of internet conspiracy theories was clunky and didn't ring true. It seems to have been written by someone who hasn't been on the internet for about 10 years. Again, that goes against the form of what I've seen people sort of saying on social media, but it's nice to get a bit of balance there. Yeah. I don't know. I think, to be honest, a lot of what it was saying was on point. It reminds me of, I've always said this, the big change for me is, you ever watch Batman Returns, the Tim Burton one with Danny DeVito?
Yes. Yeah, a while ago, yeah.
The very end where the Penguin is mayor and he's addressing the people of Gotham and there's a big tannoy speakers and he's giving his speech and the Batman on his Bat CD player plays a load of what the Penguin has said in private about the people of Gotham and it comes over the tannoy and they all start booing him and throwing tomatoes at him and he runs off defeated. It's like, I've realized now that wouldn't happen. That's no longer a realistic example. And I kind of felt at the end of this episode where suddenly everything turned and it was suddenly, you know, about how cool Ruby was and how great Unit was. I was like, I don't know. I kind of feel like we're in a position where sides are so entrenched in their ideologies, you just don't see much shifting. That we seem very much paralyzed in ideologies. They're just constantly bashing, which I think in part is because people make money out of it. And in that way, I felt that episode was actually very contemporary, because I think that is the problem, is that the people who have a lot of power, who some of them, not all, some of them are there to sow distrust, frustration, paranoia, infuel people for agendas which don't necessarily suit the people that they're enraging. It's like creating revolutions but not really believing in the revolutions. I think that's what the story is trying to suggest. And there is a bit of political statement to that, because the people I think it's alluding to, other people might disagree that that's what's going on. But I think that is a relevant topic. But yeah, I think as soon as anything sort of internet-y, I know what Phil's sort of saying there. It does somehow always feel a bit clunky when television ever tries to tap into how technology is working at the moment. It always feels a bit clunky. So I get that.
Yeah, I can understand that 100%. Yeah, that's an interesting idea, because it didn't seem right that everybody suddenly turned against comments.
I think
you just go, oh well, that's more CGI, you know, that's more another guy in latex.
He was forced to do that. There was guns around, you know, he was forced to say what he was going to say, and then he would obviously say later on in the prison, I was forced to say that, and it would all just carry on, which is a very depressing narrative to think about. But anyway, so I think we'll just end this. We're just asking, you know, Philip, I mean, you do a lot of stuff, so you say you write, you edit. What are you up to at the moment? Is there anything that you'd like to say to anyone listening to this? What's the mates up to at the moment?
Well, so next year, the Doctor Who Companion is celebrating 10 year anniversary, which is
10 years. Cool. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm trying to come up with a few projects to tie into that. I've just had a book out about all the companions, which I went to the Bedford Who Charity Con, which is run by Simon Daines and his brother.
Simon Frank. Taught me as a kid.
Oh, no way, did he?
Yeah, I was a kid in his class and he taught me religious education.
Oh, oh, isn't that weird? That's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. He's a lovely chap, and he does he raises a huge amount for charity. I was lucky enough to be there helping out and signing books and stuff, so that was great to actually meet some fans and get proper reception and gauge how much enthusiasm there is still for Doctor Who. I think that was very positive.
He used to terrify people as people at the school were terrified of him. He was a very scary teacher. when he got angry, he got angry.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He was very powerful, but I did enjoy being taught by him. I remember once, I'll say this now, and if he hears this, he won't even remember this, but there was a time where he said to someone in class, sort of slightly jokingly, he paraphrased, well, he quoted Robots of Death. He said he used the inverse. You have a classic example of an inverse ratio. But he said the size of the brain to the size of the mouth. And I remember being in the class and just thinking, "Oh, you've misquoted. You paraphrased that. It's the other way around." And I didn't say anything, obviously, because it was clearly not a moment to say anything. And I don't think he'd have liked me to undermine that misquote. Oh, but bless.
That's wonderful.
I've always remembered that. But yeah, he was a great teacher. A lot of time for Simon, or as I knew him back then, as Mr. Daines. Anyway, man. So yeah, Bedford, yeah. So how can people get the book, by the way? Is it?
Oh, it's available on Candy Jar, but in June. In June, so next month, it's being released in paperback and hardback for retail as well. So that's quite exciting. It's a huge book as well. It's 700 pages, so it's a lot of work, and it's good to get that sort of out into the public.
I think it's kind of good as well, because one of the problems with the Doctor Who Companion is as a name, if you put into Google the Doctor Who Companion, you'll tend to get companions up first before you get to the website, and now you've subverted that
by doing
a book about companions. It's sort of almost like a fuck you to your own website. Which is brilliant.
Why, thank you. It was basically Sean Russell's idea from Candy Jar. He came to me and said, you've got a website about companions. Do you want to write a book about it? So happy days, perfect. Yeah, thank you. And of course, you write for the DWC as well. You review
audios. I may be missing your review, which has been sitting half written on my laptop for like 9 months, which is pretty awful. But I've always had a lot of time for you guys and what you do, especially when Cerberus changed and you guys just took the floor and have done a great job running what is a very hard thing to do, is just to keep the whole mill approach, having to constantly keep that place current and up to date is crazy, so big respect for that. And it's great to sometimes occasionally review some of Big Finish's stuff and the likes, which is always good fun. But so we will leave it there. Thanks to Philip. There will be stuff in the show notes which Christian will put in, probably not too much. You'll probably keep the show notes fairly lean, but we will see. Otherwise we will see you for episode 5 next week with another guest, probably.
Thanks, James.